Ukraine's president said he's willing to hold direct talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin to end the war, but won't concede territory as fighting continues to rage on in the eastern Donbas region.
Particularly, they concentrate all these in the area of Severodonetsk because this is a very strategic point.
Plus, how sustainable can Ukrainian aid be in the face of a long and protracted war?
That works both ways. In addition to Ukraine continuing to be dependent on that continued security assistance, but by contrast, Russia too.
And later in the program, the difficulties facing Europe as it tries to address food insecurity brought on by the war. Today is Wednesday, May 25th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Wednesday he would be open to negotiations with Russia, but only direct talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Speaking via video link in a session at the World Economic Forum, Zelensky said, quote, "Today you can only talk to the President of the Russian Federation. There's no point in doing this with intermediaries. They are nobody. Even in this chess game, they are not on the board." End quote. Zelensky said that his country will not give up land in return for an end to the war with Russia following its invasion, and the Ukrainian leader's comments came as Russian forces bombarded eastern Ukraine and missiles struck several cities. Reporter Anna Chernikova joins us from Kyiv with more.
It was another tough night in Ukraine, and especially in the Donbas region. Heavy fightings continue there. And according to the advisor to the head of the president office, Alexei Aristovich, Russian army concentrated most of their forces in the region there. So we're talking about Donetsk and Luhansk regions. Reportedly, Russian army brought the last fresh forces they have and all possible equipment. And particularly, they concentrate all these in the area of Severodonetsk, which is Luhansk region. And this particular town is in the spotlight for the past weeks because this is a very strategic point, and this could be very important if Russian forces control it because of the logistics and other tactical stuff. For the moment, it's under Ukrainian control, but very heavy fightings are happening there.
And I also understand that in addition to the fighting that's been taking place in the Donbas region, there's also been several missile strikes throughout the country.
Almost every region had air raid sirens a couple of times throughout the night. As a result, in the morning, the Russian forces fired three missiles at Kryvyi Rih. It's a very big town. And they aimed at industrial enterprise. There were serious damages. Information about the victims is being clarified. No particular information for the moment. Hopefully, there are no victims. And this was announced by the head of the Dnipropetrovsk Regional State Administration. Another missile attack in the morning also was in Zaporizhia. Four missiles were fired. One of them were destroyed by the air defense. Currently, we know about one victim and three injured people, civilians. At least 62 houses in the private sector of the city are damaged. And this is also according to the regional military administration. Unfortunately, this could change. Also, quite tough situation remains in the Sumy region, which is on the north, and this is the area that was liberated recently. At about 1 a.m., Russian forces fired the rockets from the territory of Russian Federation. The launch was from the aircraft, and aircraft did not cross the state border. But again, about 20 houses and the power line were damaged, and for the moment, half of the village of Krasnopolye, which suffered the most, is left without electricity. No victims reported yet. I should say that there are still heavy shellings in Kharkiv region and Mykolaiv region, but again, there are, of course, more concentration is on the east for the moment.
Anna Chernikova is reporting for us from Kyiv, Ukraine. Anna, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Earlier today, I also spoke with Stephen Horrell. He's a non-resident senior fellow with the Transatlantic Defense and Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis. And I began our conversation by asking for his assessment of Russia's recent military action.
The first thing I would stress is that in addition to Russia's operational level objectives and their weight of effort in eastern Ukraine and the Donbas, they are still focused on the rest of the south. So out to the key port cities of Mykolaiv and Odessa from Kherson. They have a little less weight of effort there, but have also continued missile strikes in the region. So it's important to note it's not just the east, but also the south. So having secured the land bridge from the territories held by the Russian-led separatists in the Donbas in eastern Ukraine to Crimea with the fall of Mariupol, I think those continued operations in the east are really designed to then further expand the territorial holdings there to get to some end state. I think, you know, again, the strategic objectives of Putin at the outset of this, one of them was essentially the erasure of the Ukrainian state, you know, not to take it over, but to get rid of the Ukrainian national identity, even more than just having a pliant border state to further protect Russia. I think that's out of the question, but I think they perhaps have shifted those objectives downward to expanded control, again, in eastern Ukraine and from across to Crimea, and then from Crimea further west to take the entire Black Sea coast of Ukraine.
So can you expand upon that a little bit? Because if we look back to earlier this week with Jens Stoltenberg speaking at the World Economic Forum, he mentioned that Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, had failed to achieve his initial objectives in Ukraine. And you just mentioned that perhaps Russia is downgrading its overall objective. So what do you see as perhaps a realistic objective for the Russian military operations in Ukraine?
I definitely agree with the Secretary General. Those initial strategic objectives were clear, you know, to completely take over Ukraine, but also that national identity question of Ukraine as a nation state rather than just little Russians and other Russian speakers. Secretary General Stoltenberg probably talked as well. You know, Putin quite clearly said a strategic objective was to redraw the global security architecture. I think that's happening, but not necessarily in the way he envisioned out there. So with those two objectives, you know, clearly will not be met. I think even the greatest Russian success in the current offensive in eastern Ukraine and the Donbas would not get to taking over the entire Ukraine territorially, but more importantly to him now, the decapitation of the Zelensky administration. It's very, very hard to see a path from the current situation to that. So now let's go back to during the force buildup, when there was a lot of debate about will this or will this not be a full-scale invasion. You know, remember that there's a lot of talk about limited objectives or a limited invasion, and that all centered a lot around the expansion of the territories held by the Russian-led separatists in Donbas. Frequently, that was talked about to the administrative borders of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. But again, that connection across the coast of the Sea of Azov, the land bridge to the Crimean Peninsula, and there was more musing then, but again, about Odessa.
My last question for you is this. How sustainable do you see the continued level of giving to Ukraine, given that even by Zelensky's own admission, they need billions of dollars every month to keep the government and the military operations defending their territorial integrity going?
So that is a great question. I will say this overall, that works both ways. In addition to Ukraine continuing to be dependent on that continued security assistance from the West, equipment and hardware from platforms down to ammunition, Ukraine will continue to be dependent on us continuing that flow of not just hardware, but intelligence sharing and other things going in there. But by contrast, Russia, too, facing a long drawn out conflict, has to consider the stocks of not just ammunition, but equipment like tanks, et cetera.
Stephen Horrell is a non-resident senior fellow with the Transatlantic Defense and Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis. Stephen, thank you.
Great talking to you.
Chinese state media recently mentioned that several journalists criticized Western news outlets for biased reporting on Russia's war in Ukraine. Polygraph.info explains why that is misleading.
On May 17th, state-run China National Radio posted a video on the social media site Weibo. The post proclaimed, quote, "In a recent United Nations meeting, independent journalists from France, Italy, the Netherlands, and other countries criticized Western media for false propaganda in their coverage of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. They had been, quote, fired for truthfully covering the conflict," the post claimed. That is misleading. In fact, several of the, quote, "independent journalists" have a track record of parroting Kremlin propaganda. The UN meeting was an informal session Russia orchestrated on its own. Mostly, the invited journalists falsely blamed Ukraine for Russia's carnage. They repeated the lie that Ukraine blew up civilians in a Mariupol theater, not the Russian airstrike that witnesses described. And they falsely accused Ukraine of using civilians as shields when the BBC found, quote, "clear evidence that Russian troops did so." The international community and Ukraine are investigating thousands of alleged Russian war crimes. On May 23rd, a Ukrainian court sentenced a Russian soldier to life in prison for shooting an unarmed 62-year-old Ukrainian man, Oleksandr Shelipov.
Polygraph.info is a fact-checking website produced by the Voice of America. The website serves as a resource for verifying the increasing volume of disinformation and misinformation being distributed and shared globally. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. So far, Russia's oil exports have not slowed down a bit from the war in Ukraine and international sanctions. In fact, Russia exported more oil in April than it did before the war, and high oil prices mean Moscow is raking in the money. That's one reason Europe is considering a Russian oil ban. Current sanctions aren't hurting Moscow enough. Europe gets most of its oil from Russia, more than anywhere else, and it would have to make up for those banned barrels of oil somewhere else, and that won't be easy. It's also likely to push up the prices of oil everywhere even further. VOA's Steve Barragona takes it from here.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, sanctions aimed to starve the Russian economy. But the sanctions didn't touch Russia's energy exports. That's largely because Europe depends on them. Several big Europe-based energy companies have said they will stop buying Russian oil.
But the case is still that a lot of that crude is going into European countries. Very few have halted flows.
Cargo tracking firm Kepler says Russia's exports to Europe dropped a bit in March and April, but not much.
As a number of these European countries have realized that, yes, they're being chastised, yes, they're being named and shamed for taking these crude products, there isn't anything to stop them actually taking it still, and so then we've seen them continuing. And so there hasn't really been much of a change. And it appears there won't be much of a change until we see an embargo or sanctions put on those flows.
Those flows have actually increased to other parts of the world. Overall, Russia is exporting more oil now than it has in years. Because some buyers are shying away from Russian oil, Moscow has had to sell it at a deep discount, around 35%, which is great for countries like India.
Prior to the invasion of Ukraine, India wasn't really much of a buyer of Russian crude. They bought it sporadically last year. They brought in like 14 million barrels over the whole period. But since the invasion, and because that oil has got so cheap, by early June, they have brought in like double that amount.
Even with the discount, Russia stands to make more money this year than last year because oil prices are so high.
Policymakers in Europe are uncomfortable with this because they feel like it's not putting much pressure on the Russian government. It's not really depriving them of revenue. So they're looking at options now to try to ratchet up that pressure and take more Russian oil off the market and create a bigger revenue impact.
Banning Russian oil would leave Europe short about 4.5 million barrels a day. That oil would have to come from somewhere else. It's just one problem.
It's a tight oil market. I mean, it was a tight oil market before Russia invaded Ukraine. The OPEC plus countries really don't have a lot of spare capacity that they can bring online. So everyone's kind of waiting to see what happens in the United States. And growth there has been, you know, lower than many people would like.
U.S. oil companies are struggling to find workers. Equipment and supplies are hard to find. And even though the United States is now the world's largest oil producer, the industry is having trouble raising money to increase production.
We had 10 years of enormous expansion in oil production in the United States, you know, the first decade of the shale boom. I mean, incredible growth year on year. It was good for production, it was good for revenues, provided a lot of jobs. But from an investor standpoint, it was not a success.
The U.S. oil boom never really paid off for investors, and they're not eager to pour more money into drilling like they did a few years ago. Prices are high enough now to lure companies back in. U.S. output may grow by about 1 million barrels per day by the end of the year. But that won't be enough to plug the hole in Europe from banning Russian oil.
Really, Europe is going to have to pull in from all manner of places. They're replacing some of that Russian crude already with crude from the North Sea. They're going to have to pull from the Middle East as well, from West Africa, from essentially everywhere to be replacing, you know, millions of barrels of crude a day. So that's ultimately going to result in higher prices.
Those higher prices will hurt around the world, but it would put more pressure on Russia. 60% of its oil exports go to Europe.
Well, the challenge for Russia is that because they send so much into Europe, they're really going to struggle to find another destination.
India and China will probably take some, but they don't have the infrastructure to take it all. And Russia probably will have to cut the price even further. It's a major global shift in oil markets that's going to take some time to work out.
A huge thanks to our own Steve Barragona for that report. The European Union on Tuesday accused Russia of using food as a weapon to blackmail poor countries as the bloc looks for ways to export, either by land or possibly by sea, millions of tons of stored Ukrainian grain that's being trapped by a Russian port blockade. Lisa Bryant continues her coverage.
Speaking at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen accused Moscow of weaponizing food security, as she says it has with energy exports.
In Russian-occupied Ukraine, the Kremlin's army is confiscating grain stocks and machinery. Today, Russia's artillery is bombarding grain warehouses in Ukraine, deliberately. And Russian warships in the Black Sea are blockading Ukrainian ships full of wheat and sunflower seeds.
The European Union says the bloc is largely food self-sufficient, although the Ukraine war has bumped up food and fertilizer prices. The poorest countries and their people are feeling the biggest hit. Ukraine and Russia count among the world's top exporters of grains and cooking oil.
Bread prices in Lebanon have increased by 70%, and food shipments from Odessa could not reach Somalia.
Moscow blames the food crisis on Western sanctions against it. With Russia blockading Ukraine's ports that once exported 90% of Kyiv's goods, European agricultural ministers were meeting Tuesday to discuss land options. Solutions need to be found fast, before Ukraine's next harvest, or there will be no place to store it. Here's Finnish agricultural minister Antti Kurvinen on the EU's so-called solidarity lanes, intended to export Ukrainian harvests largely by rail and road.
I see the solidarity lanes very important because I'm really worried about the global food security. Maybe we in Europe can manage, but not every people in developing countries.
Jörg Sackmann, a senior fellow for Brussels Economic Research Group Bruegel, says there are several export alternatives to Ukrainian ports, including shipping from neighboring Romania.
The next option is to bring the grain via either truck or via train to the essentially Polish border.
But he says there are logistical and regulatory challenges.
There's a couple of different elements one can do to ease the bottlenecks, but whether it all adds up to a massive amount of grain exports is another question.
Ukrainian officials say Landrut's can only export a fraction of the goods. Meanwhile, EU member state Lithuania has proposed a non-military naval coalition to protect Ukrainian grain exports by sea as a humanitarian mission. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Every day, the Ukrainian Refugee Registration Center in Brussels sees thousands of newcomers. They're mostly women and children who are trying to escape the war in Ukraine. Even with help, refugees face a daunting reality as they try to rebuild their lives. Anna Rice narrates this report to round us out.
Thousands of people gathered outside the registration center in Brussels for Ukrainian refugees. Refugees like Anna Pilavska face their latest challenge, registering in a new country and finding a job and housing.
I didn't want to leave my parents, my husband. That's why we were waiting, but every day it became worse. And then my husband told me, we need to save our daughter. You need to leave. Get into the car. We are off.
It took them 3 days to drive from Kiev to the Hungarian border.
The plan was to find a safe route to stay away from military action, where we could be wounded or shelled. So we took tiny roads, stayed with people we knew for the night, and then continued our journey. One day we only managed to drive for 150 kilometers.
Pilavska and her daughter are staying in Brussels with her husband's business partner. He took them to the registration center, but found it closed much earlier than expected.
They told me it was going to be open until 5 o'clock this afternoon. It's already closed now, so it looks like I've got to drive back home and come back another day.
The registration center can register 2,000 Ukrainian refugees a day and reaches its limit as early as noon, say Belgium authorities. Many spend the night in tents outside, waiting for their turn. Still, refugees say they're grateful for the support.
People here are very sympathetic. My husband posted online asking for help for Ukrainian families, and immediately a Belgian family offered the second floor of their house to a family from Ukraine. The Red Cross stepped in, local churches that offered groceries and all the necessities.
Natalia Ulyanova left Western Ukraine on March 9th and traveled to Brussels to live with her son. As she traveled through the Lviv region, she says air raid sirens went off every day, prompting her to run for cover.
I would hide not in a bomb shelter, but in a basement of our building. I know it was dangerous, but I didn't have a choice. The shelter was far and I have back problems and cannot walk for long.
After she registers at the center, Ulyanova says her son will help her adapt to a new country. But for many other Ukrainians, there is no one here to help. Despite the new EU Temporary Protection Directive that granted Ukrainian refugees a temporary residence permit and the right to work, finding a job is a challenge.
The main problem is the language. I am a teacher, and the only thing I can do now is become a cleaning lady or a babysitter. My professional skills and education do not matter.
Anna's situation is not unique. There are thousands more just like her here in Belgium, and now millions more in other European countries. For Valentina Vasileva in Brussels, Anna Rice, VOA News.
And that's going to do it for us today. Be sure to stay up to date with our continuing coverage on Ukraine, as well as news and events from around the world. You can do so 24 hours a day at voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms. Just be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire team at Flashpoint Ukraine, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Steve Miller. Be well, be safe, and good night.
This is the voice of America, Washington, ba-ba-bo-zip. DC.